In the following recording by the LA Sound Posse, you will hear Dr. Claire Spark in her second appearance on Michael Woodson's Living Art program on Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. She continues her detailed interpretation of her soon-to-be-released in paperback, Hunting Captain Ahab, Psychological Warfare and the Melville Revival. The program aired on November 25th of 2005.
KPFT Houston, you are listening to Living Art. I'm Michael Woodson here in gray-skied, almost sunny, pleasant weather, Houston, Texas. With us today is Claire Spark, and she's going to be talking to us from her home in California on this 25th day of November in 2005. So with that, we will go to Claire Spark, who is a critic, historian, cultural narrative artist, a longtime Pacifican, former program director of KPFK in Los Angeles, and she's also a programmer from there, a very well-known programmer out there. She is the author of the mega magnificent Hunting Captain Ahab, and we're going to talk about all kinds of things, Melville, Hitler, capitalism,
sadomasochism,
and many points in between. Mm-hmm. But I want to start by talking about the double bind, and
which we brought up last time,
right?
Some sublinks.
And we'll go ahead and talk about the importance of the double bind in your critical position.
Well, it's probably the key concept in all of my work ever since I started reading Melville, especially his book Pierre, which is the much-trashed novel that followed Moby Dick, and which brings his long and sometimes confusing novel Moby Dick back to the family where it belongs. It's a thinly disguised account of the social relations in his own family, and it's completely wild. And it was deemed crazy and unreadable, and, you know, it was almost a forbidden book, because even today, people will trash Pierre. And it's an artist, however, have found it enchanting, full of images. A French filmmaker made a modern movie out of it. It's completely wonderful. And from Pierre, I learned how important the double bind was to Melville, which was, and this will interest your listeners who are artists or any kind of creative person trying to find originality or to make discoveries. So this could be an artist, a scientist, a curious person who wants to teach herself or himself about the confusing structures of institutions in which they have to function. Melville very much wanted to be an artist, the kind that can relate in through artistic narratives, through exciting novels and so on, his own process of growth as a creative person, whether that entailed seeing an utterly different culture in the South Seas and the Marquesas in his first few books, Typee and Omu, or the kinds of ideas that he got from simply living in New York in the 1840s and 1850s, which are the time of his most famous creativity, where he wrote Moby Dick and Pierre and The Confidence Man and started writing poetry and the famous short stories that everyone will know, or many people will know, at least from high school, Bartleby the Scrivener, Benito Cereno, if they're, you know, into slave revolts and so on. But what he found out was that he certainly felt that he was under the most stringent kind of censorship, because what he wanted to say would be very disruptive, not only to his much more conservative family, but also to his patronage system and to the reading public. And what his mother had clearly told him, and as is revealed in Pierre, the character that represents his mother, is that there's no conflict between telling the truth as you see it, relating your life experience and all its craziness and contradictoriness. There's no conflict between that and order. In other words, you can write what you want and the world won't fall apart. It won't become fragmented. Other people will not be angry with you. They will not try to censor you. They will not try to, you know, take away your source of support. And so that double bind, the conflict between truth and order, that there is no conflict, is something that I saw replicated in many other institutions at later times. In the Columbia, there was a big, you've read this chapter in my book, Michael, so you'll know, there was a huge stink at Columbia in 1917 over academic freedom when two anti-war professors were suddenly dismissed. And the school was in strike mode, huge uproar. They were terribly upset, and people taking sides all over the place. Should these anti-war professors been allowed to use the name of Columbia to protest American participation in World War I, or should they be fired? And the resolution that Columbia came out with was, or at least some of them came out with, was, there's no conflict in developing a critical, independent mind and utter loyalty to the state. Now, this just, when I saw that, I thought I had died and gone to heaven, because that was exactly the situation in Melville's family. He had to be completely loyal to the values of his family, or he couldn't grow as a writer and say what he really wanted to say about how, and what he wanted to say is really important. He felt, and this comes out in Pierre through the character of Isabel, that the people in charge are crazy, demented, soul-wandering, demented people and broken spirits. So this is really heavy, to feel that the people who have power over you, who are supposed to protect you, are quite mad. And their madness consists in believing you can be independent and have your own perceptions and yet be utterly loyal to the state. Now, fast forward to the present. It doesn't matter if we're talking about the people that Pacificans generally dislike, namely the government or the Republican Party or blah, 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 blah. It could be a party line. It could be a party line of whatever sect we're loyal to, assuming we're in a sect, some kind of left-wing sect, whether it's a Democratic Party or Trotskyism or some form of Leninism, Stalinism, what have you. And I said this the last time we were on the air, that artists, if they are going to be true to themselves, cannot submit themselves to the rules of any institution or the ideology of any political party or social movement. If they do that, they have given up their right to make a statement which reflects their own individuality. Now, it doesn't mean that the first impulse that they have is always accurate. It means that if they're going to submit, which is what the sadomasochist does, what the masochist does, then they are going to give up the whole process of learning and refining their vision and checking their errors, whether it's by themselves through reading and study or from the feedback of others. If I answered your question clearly enough?
Sure, right. It's a complicated thing, and you brought up sadomasochism, and I couldn't quite make that leap where I was coming from. So,
well, let's take one of the characters who did the most to shape the way many people think about the Melville Revival. He was a very important Harvard professor and practically self-taught Jungian psychoanalyst named Henry A. Murray, whose name may be familiar to some of our listeners because he was royally trashed in a recent book by Owen Chase called The Making of the Unabomber. Murray was at Harvard. He was director of the Harvard Clinic, and he was involving the students in experiments that were quite odd. And Kaczynski was one of the students, and this particular author who wrote about the making of the Unabomber blamed Murray for destroying Kaczynski's mind and turning him into this violent terrorist. Well, I know a lot about Henry Murray because As I said, he was one of the chief shapers of the Melville Revival at the same time that he was writing a long-distance psychoanalysis of Hitler's mind for the Roosevelt administration that he started in 1938, filed with the OSS in 1943. Now, in this report...
For FDR.
It was a confidential report that I acquired in 1989 that is now, however, online, I think, at the Cornell Law Library, finally. It's about 80... many, many pages, and it is a hoot. When I used to have my radio program in Los Angeles, The Sour Apple Tree, I had something called the Ooh La La Department, where things would come in the mail that were so off the wall that I would simply read them straight, and I would, of course, crack up because they were so absurd. That's the report on Hitler's personality that Murray filed, the whole thing. I want to talk about Murray's, what was in that report that's very relevant, that has never been revealed by anybody until I suppose, somebody looking up the report at the Cornell Law Library that's now available to everyone, because it used to be secret. Rather close to the beginning, he suggests 21 ways that Hitler's method of mind management could be adopted by our own government because of Hitler's uncanny insight into the minds of the little people who were the source of fascism. Because Murray had a typical aristocratic view that fascism was the revolt of the masses. It was the result of ordinary people getting uppity ideas because for five centuries they had been reading for themselves without the guidance of aristocratic elites, the church, the king, and their various surrogates who were instructing the masses to believe that they, the masses, were stupid, that they shouldn't have power because they weren't trained to rule, and because they didn't have the self-control to rule, because a good, wise ruler, the good king, is able to renounce certain instincts, such as, you know, overt aggression, extremism, fanaticism, in order to find the middle way, in order to find compromise that will take people who are out of control fighting with each other, get them to calm down and simply find a middle way, a compromise that will bring peace and restore order. But the ordinary people, like you and me, autodidacts, say, people who teach themselves and who believe that they can acquire knowledge, that they should have the power to represent themselves, that they should have the power to be in a republic where they choose their rulers and can have feedback upon the laws that are made, help at least consent to the laws that are made, and that this is good, that they're good in doing that. This was a revolution in the history of humanity. There had never been anything like this before, that ordinary people were the repositories of power, knowledge, and virtue, as opposed to kings, churches, and aristocrats, and so on, had the superior self-control. Move now to sadomasochism, and one of the defining features of the functioning superior person who is a sadomasochist. They indulge in tight lacing. They will wear corsets that pull in their waist and control the fat over their stomachs and so on. This gesture, this actual aesthetic of tight lacing, signifies the self-control, the moderation of the person who resists the desire to become a fanatic or an extremist. Unlike Melville's Captain Ahab, who is the fanatic and demagogue, you know, extraordinaire, who can whip up the masses and become the prototype for Hitler in the 20th century. And this was Henry Murray's line, that Ahab was a prefiguration through his demagoguery of Hitler, the failed artist, who, to compensate for his failure, became the boss of the world, and by the way, probably had Jewish blood, which explains how somebody from Austrian peasant stock could have taken over the world and fooled all of those hip aristocratic rulers in the West.
You're listening to Claire Spark on Living Art, KPFT Houston, and we're talking about literary criticism, history, Hitler, sadomasochism, and
the
all points
revival.
In between.
One of the chief architects of the revival of Herman Melville's reputation. Your listeners may not know that Melville sort of withdrew. He pretty much withdrew from public authorship after the Civil War, and died a forgotten man. He was revived starting in the period immediately following World War I in successive waves of interest. He was really an artist at that. Artists always knew about Melville.
And kind of a person who, after his commercial success, delved into literary symbolic material that wasn't too palatable to the general public. But
it was always really not, well, except for his first few books, which were excited and sexy and semi-pornographic, namely Typee and Omu. Yeah, he lost his celebrity as soon as he got ambitious and tried to write philosophically and works that were critical of these institutions that had double binds in them. His family started in on him and tried to get him to do anything but be a writer. They couldn't tolerate this exposure of the family's, you know, infliction of their double messages. And these double messages, trust me, are handed out today in graduate school and probably in undergraduate courses in the humanities as well. There is no conflict between discovery and order. If you can study, and whatever you find, and if it's well argued, you will be rewarded. Well, forget that. You had better follow the line of the teacher who's teaching the class. And if you don't, if they're at all tolerant, they may put up with it. But on the other hand, they may not. And that's what's, you know, being fought about so much in the culture wars today.
Order triumphs truth, and Melville referred to something along those lines with his famous phrase, virtuous expediency.
Exactly, which comes out in Pierre. Pierre, who is a writer and the hero of the book, or certainly the protagonist of the novel, comes across a pamphlet, which Melville often does this. His characters will find scribbled on a wall in pencil or in a piece of paper some kind of graffito or some kind of shred of something, a fragment that gives Melville an excuse to expatiate on his detesting of the moderate men and their double-talking ways. In this case, it's a pamphlet by one Plotinus Plinlimon in which it advocates virtuous expediency, which, of course, is an oxymoron. You can't be expedient and ruthless and pragmatic at the same time retain your credentials for being a true Christian, you know, a representative of all the humane virtues and walking the line, as Donny Cass says, walking the narrow line by being a good person, an honest person, a caring person, a forgiving person, and so on. And, of course, Henry Murray, who I mentioned about 10 minutes ago, the famous Harvard psychologist and mover and shaker, was a typical advocate of virtuous expediency. These men who controlled sociology, the new social relations, explanations for fascism, were all these moderates who blamed, if you were a prejudiced person, if you were anti-Semitic, or if you were anti-business, or if you hated black people, or any group, you were obviously projecting your own inner conflicts onto the other, they said. Because there are no real conflicts in the world that can't be negotiated and compromised. That's the reasoning. But we all have these evil impulses inside of us, uncontrollable sex, uncontrollable aggression. and the will to power, in other words, to overthrow the kings and the church and so on. They, the rulers, are wonderfully in control of these impulses. The rest of us have to be instructed in the ways of submitting to their leadership, because they're the ones who are going to mediate the conflicts that we're in. Because we're extremists and out of control when we want to, say, eliminate slavery in America in the 19th century, or make women equal in the 20th century, or any of the other civil rights issues that have surfaced since at least the 1960s, if not before, or have rights for labor, et cetera, et cetera. So we're the potential extremists and enthusiasts, and the people who mediate are marvelously objective, marvelously artful in manipulating us to believe that we're actually getting what we want when we submit to their arbitration.
And really unmindful of the radical experiment that perhaps partially gave birth to the Constitution of the United States.
Oh, exactly. They have to rewrite the Enlightenment. Instead of, that's a really good point, Michael. Instead of following the truth wherever it leads in the way that scientists are supposed to do, instead of accurately reporting your discoveries and having your colleagues, you know, evaluate them and try to replicate your experiments and see if they get the same results, these moderate men who Melville constantly mocked in all of his writings, after Moby Dick and Pierre, you blinker yourself, you tighten your corset, you read selectively, you shape what you find to the acceptable formulations of your reading committee if you're in graduate school, to museum curators if you're an artist trying to get a show who want to represent your work in a certain way, to critics who are powerful opinion makers. And this really comes out in the most recent treatments of Melville's Moby Dick. There's been a lot of reviews lately of Andrew Del Banco's book. Instead of looking at Melville's life in any compassionate way, which would demonstrate an emotional connection to the dilemmas that he faced in trying to realize his artistic powers, they look forward and insist that he's a prophet of Hitler because they know that he really is Ahab. And Ahab is this terrible man who's leading the ship of state to certain catastrophe, knows he's doing it, is crazy, is a monomaniac, is a demagogue, just like Hitler was. And these people, therefore, have the same analysis of Hitler's appeal and what Hitler was, as the, for dare I say the word, social democrats who prevailed in the Roosevelt administration and controlled readings of fascism after the war. So instead of looking at class interests, the stupidity of the left in allowing Hitler to come to power in the first place, their internal squabbling, the problems that all Western societies faced during the Depression and how they solved it in similar ways through the welfare state, as Hitler did in many ways with his social programs. They say, oh, well, Hitler was this unique outsider, this terrible sadistic person. We can't really understand his mind, but he does remind us somehow of artists and criminals sort of melded together. And he exerted this uncanny hold on the little people and got them to follow him. So all of a sudden, all romantic artists become potential Hitlers. And that was Murray's line in his secret report to FDR, that Hitler was a compound of Lord Byron, the most left-wing of all the romantics, and Al Capone. He actually says this. And in the same secret report, he kind of free associates to Melville by saying that Hitler was an autodidact, that he learned what he learned about diplomacy and strategy in the libraries never went to college in the same way that there's a famous line in Moby Dick where Ishmael says, a whale ship was my Harvard and Yale. And Murray has a similar sentence in his report to FDR. So he clearly associates Melville, Ahab, and Hitler. And the worst part is he gives credence to the rumor that Hitler had Jewish blood. And it was, in fact, the grandson of the Baron Rothschild, which is also given credence in the famous Walter Langer report on Hitler's mind, which was almost a replication of Murray's secret report, which very few people know about.
All right. And that's probably an inflammatory point. I'm going to talk about that as inflammatory, if it is. When we come back, you know, from the break, and
I'm sure your listeners could use a break right now.
There's so much going on. So I want to talk about the Jewish question, as well as historical and literary criticisms turned toward what I'll call essentialism and neglect of enlightened materialism when we come back. And now back to Claire. Anti-Semitism is such a volatile thing that to say that Hitler was Jewish is going to really, really create a stir one way or the other. So
I don't mean, of course, that Hitler was Jewish. What I'm saying is he was given Jewish attributes by very powerful professors at Harvard and elsewhere who worked for the government. And what's shocking about it is that this hasn't come out, although people who are very interested in interpretations of Hitler know that this rumor was around. It's important to specify what it is about being Jewish that made it easy for them to nail this on Hitler. First of all, there was a mystery about his grandfather. Apparently, his grandmother was impregnated by somebody in a house that she worked for, and there were rumors that Hitler himself may have believed that he had a Jewish grandfather. What's shocking is that persons like Walter Langer and Henry Murray could have thought it logical that Hitler had Jewish blood, because in their racism, they didn't believe that a peasant could have ever pulled the wool over their eyes, because Hitler played, you know, quite a game with the Western powers throughout the 1930s. And he was used by them to fight the Soviet Union, to oppose the Soviet Union, and to control communism within Germany by segments of Western elites. So he was useful to them. But then, hello, he turns on them in the late 30s, and there's no way that they can say, or they're not going to have to fight him. Now, what's the Jewish part of Hitler in their fevered imaginations is this. Hitler, they say, was always a cynical swindler of the masses, just as the old myths about Jewish power would allege. Jews, in the protocols of the elders of Zion and so on, only pretend to be the friends of the people, bringing institutions that will lift people out of poverty, bringing mass media that will help educate everybody as to what's going on in the world. The Jews actually, in their minds, in the anti-Semites' minds, control mass media, not just because they want to make money, but because they want to raise the masses against their masters and start revolutions in which the Jews will benefit, because the Jews are not only the arch capitalists, they are the arch purveyors of modernity, in which materialism is the dominant value, and then everyone will turn into a communist, into a Bolshevist. So in Hitler's mind, the Soviet Union was uniquely Jewish in its Bolshevism. He called it Jewish Bolshevism. He called modern art Jewish Bolshevist art, and it had to be stamped out.
And at the same, the point of Murray being that this is a projection of Hitler, who had, according to Murray, some Rothschild blood.
Well, he believed, he thought it was plausible. And he also thought that Hitler was a sexual pervert. He's the one who came up with the, he would make all, Murray would do this all the time. He did it in his Melville criticism. He would make the most god-awful inferences from the parts of Melville's writing that were morbid or that showed, you know, uncontrollable anger or acting out anger against the moderate men and so on, or that showed Melville as a revolutionary in his narrative of White Jacket.
And Murray would not be appreciative of the image of the wandering Jew in literature.
Not at all. And Ahab is certainly the romantic wandering Jew. The wandering Jew is a very important image, as you know and other writers know, because he's rootless. And he's all over the world. He comes to understand all cultures. You can't contain him. If you put him in prison, he breaks out. Walls mean nothing to him. The walls that people erect between categories or between cultures. And it's obviously resonant with history of the Jews who were kicked out of one country after another and had to adapt to many different societies.
And they become the boogie person, the boogeyman of culture then.
In the modern world, because the myth is that the Jews have always wanted to dominate the rest of the world, that they're the chosen people, and it's, of course, a total misunderstanding of Jewish history, that the mission of the Jews is to repair the world and to help people, to lift up the oppressed, and to bring the law that makes it possible to end human sacrifice and criminality, to have honest business dealings, to be kind to the stranger. All of this is twisted in the minds of Christian anti-Semites. And I must say, in this Harvard cohort that I've been studying and whose really shocking behavior is laid out in my book, Hunting Captain Ahab, Psychological Warfare and the Melville Revival.
Well, what about the turn from materialist perspectives on literature in this country, anyway, and the East. Essentialism criticism, where you bring up symbolism or psychology or heredity or something like that.
As multicultural humanities curriculum does,
which is the current. And
yeah, which
pervasive.
It's so hegemonic, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable. In the 19th century, artists were like the romantic wandering Jew, first of all, on the side of human emancipation from arbitrary authority, number one.
We have Icarus and Prometheus.
That's right, Prometheus.
Images.
But the enemies of Prometheus used the myths of Narcissus and Icarus to warn the Prometheans, the artists that we, you know, the original standalone artists, in-your-face artists, that if they persisted in their self-love, they would be blinded to the needs of society, and they themselves would crash and burn. So they have these wings. They can't really fly. They crash to earth, and they drown, or they fall dead. So those are the cautionary myths to discourage all of us from using our minds and our imaginations to be citizens and to be creative. In the 19th century, as many of you will know, realism and naturalism were the thing for artists and writers. They observed the world around them and showed classes, the different ways the classes thought about things. They showed conflict. They depicted the problems of all groups in society, and they didn't confuse individuals with groups. Individuals had individuality. Everyone was different from everyone else, and you didn't know what they would be like before you encountered them and got to know them. Now, it's, you know, with the onset of certain German romantic ideas, which are realized now as multiculturalism, you know what a person's going to be like before you've met them if you indulge in this kind of racialist thinking, because they have something called group character or national character. They're other words, they're stereotypes, and they all think in a certain way, and they all have the same group interests, so that you can carve up your school into various studies programs. There aren't differences, it is alleged, between men and women in these groups. There's no conflicts. There aren't class conflicts that can't be smoothed over. And they're treated as separate interest groups with their own histories that are somehow incomprehensible to the rest of us because we don't have their genes. We don't have their historical experience, which is stored in our collective unconsciouses, in the group unconscious. That's a Jungian idea.
Right.
Very pernicious. So it makes sense it's such a terrible reversal of the civil rights movement. Instead of having integration where we learn about each other as individuals, and yes, of course, our group histories are important because they're carried down very often by our families and we have to deal with them, whether we like them or not. But we don't see each other as individuals. We see each other as, you know, categories to be checked off in a census. We're black, we're brown, we're Native American, we're Caucasian, we're other, which is often Jewish. I mean, it's total madness, and it's, of course, terribly counter-revolutionary because it prevents people from uniting as a species to agree on measures and institutional reform that would benefit everyone and raise everyone up.
I don't think you can underestimate the importance of Jung and his role in criticism to bring us towards some sort of historical psychology and how this sort of undermines the Enlightenment materialist perspective.
And the penetration of Jungian ideas into the curriculum is intense. It is so huge that I cannot begin to tell you. I was, one of my degrees is in education, in science education. And I'm used to, you know, reading really bad books on education. And I started researching the influence of Jung and his ideas. And I was appalled to see how much in favor he was. Now, Murray was a Jungian. Walter Langer, who was a colleague of Murray's at Harvard, also seemed to believe in these Jungian ideas. And many new leftists and new age people, of course, adore Jung. And by the way, did I mention that Murray Pratt was a practicing sadomasochist, as came out in several biographies of him that were published in the 1990s?
You did not.
No, I didn't mention that. I was going to tie all of that up together. It's very, it's
so he's
a very sick world. And oh,
Hitler was a projection of Murray, is what you're suggesting.
Pardon?
Hitler, his analysis of Hitler is mm-hmm. perhaps a projection of himself.
Exactly. Murray was the one who came out with the idea that Hitler's sexuality was extremely perverted and that he wanted women to defecate upon him. And he associated this with the Jews, or at least Langer did it in his book on the secret report.
Which you argue is influenced by Murray's.
Yes. By the way, I should tell your listeners that I published that article on, I call it Clara Hitler's Son, Reading the Langer Report, that has all this stuff in it, the shenanigans of this group. I have it on an e-file. It was published in a journal called Social Thought and Research. It's pretty buried in that, but I'm sure they won't mind if I send it out to interested listeners. So before the end of the program, we should give my email address. Also, I will send them, if they want to see my essay on sadomasochism, which I read on KPFK in Los Angeles. It was one of the most popular programs I ever did. It was after two horrible weeks in the sadomasochism collection at UCLA, which taught me more than I'd ever wanted to learn about the minds of middle managers.
And places far flung in between. We can talk about middle managers now.
Okay. This is the talk about being in a double bind. They're supposed to be neutral and doing it. This entails, by the way, who are the middle managers? I don't just mean middle managers in corporations. Teachers, doctors, healers in general, even artists can all be considered middle managers to the extent that they're supposed to instruct and help those who are their patients or clients or readers or viewers and so on but they don't really control their work under the, you know, the current set of institutional arrangements in either this or probably any other society. And this is probably one of the better societies for being independent.
Hence middle managers, sado masochists.
And their characteristic, when they're sadomasochistic, which is often and often unconsciously, they're simply acting out their class relations. They have to take orders, however veiled, from above, and they, because they're not faithful to their vision, they're in fact dominating those who are below them.
Sadists. Now, I wanted to ask you, I saw this in reading Clara Hitler's Son, which I received from you on cspark@ix.netcom.com, which we'll give again.
Yeah.
But when did that idea pop into your head? Is there a material point that you can tell me you kind of discovered this idea?
I'm so glad you asked me this, because I want to tell you, I went to three very good schools, Cornell, Harvard, and UCLA. In between was Pacifica, between Harvard and my marriage and children, and then graduate school at UCLA at history. Nobody taught me this. Everything I've said on this program and the one we did previously, trust me, no one taught me. I had to find it on my own through a kind of just following the trail like a detective. You start reading one thing, you say, what the hell is this? Nobody ever talked about this in school. And so you just look at their sources, you read what they read, and you follow a trail, and you assemble fragments, and you finally get, you know, a picture in your head of how their minds work and where these ideas came from and what their cultural influence has been.
Well, how do you know it's a big idea? And then how do you know to track it, you know, to develop it?
Because it grabs you. Because in my own case, it explained a lot in my life and my own anxieties. I had huge anxiety about putting my work out in the world. I remember when I did one of my first collages was about authoritarian child rearing when I was at KPFK and doing The Sour Apple Tree.
Collage is your style of criticism?
Yeah, I would do collages all the time and assemble these fragments around themes. And this one was built around two recordings that a young artist had lent to me. And these were conditioning records that you would play for your child while the child was asleep. The themes were good manners and being happy. And when I heard these recordings, which were supposed to, you know, shape the child's brain while the child is asleep, when they're just little kids, about the importance of good manners and how you make everybody happy when you're happy, I really thought I was just so terrified. And I knew I had to do a program about it. So it turned into a program about fascist-style mind management in everyday life today. And I worked in the recordings, you know, that I had in the collage. Well, it was a very powerful program. And when I heard it actually coming out over the airwaves when it was broadcast, I had to lie down, and my hands were sweating, and I was sure that they were going to come and get me. You know, that they were going to come get me. That I had stepped over the line that I had put together something.
I'm glad you're laughing.
That couldn't be said. It was definitely a no-no. And that's been my whole life ever since. I'm really, really scared. When Paul Metcalf put together our correspondence about Melville's family and how important the double bind was and what problems he had with his mother and communication in the family and how it was repeated in Paul Metcalf's family, Paul's a poet. He's the great-grandson.
And the name of the book is Enter Isabel.
Yeah, artists really like that one. For one thing, it's short, unlike Captain Mayhem. And it's very conversational because it's letters, you know, and parts of the first draft of my forbidden dissertation. I was sure that I was going to be kicked out of graduate school when that was published because I hadn't gotten my degree yet, and I had said very frank things about being a graduate student that I didn't feel I was really there, that I was playing a role, you know, that I was only masquerading as an academic because I was really a renegade artist and would never fit in. And, you know, I would be found out that I was some kind of undercover. I'd gone undercover, as it were. But there's, you know, we all have libraries. I mean, most of us have libraries. And the even if we're in a smaller city that doesn't have a great library like UCLA or Harvard or Cornell or whatever, you can get books through interlibrary loan. Or now that there the Internet exists, there's all kinds of possibilities for doing research. So what I would simply do is say some artist was represented by the people I didn't like who had power over me. I would just go back and read that what that person said in his own voice. And I would note the strong contrast between what the artist or writer was saying versus what other people were saying about that person's writing. Well, if you keep doing this, your world will, you know, you'll find that you're reconfiguring your world, that it'll be like a kaleidoscope. The fragments will adhere to new patterns, and you'll see these patterns. And if you start, you know, slowly it will be revealed to you through your own work and your own research who enforces these readings of text. And, you know, you go back to the 1930s and look at the literary journals. One of the most upsetting ones was a journal called American Review that was in existence from 1934 to 36 that reviewed poetry and new economic theories, and they supported Hitler and Mussolini. And many of the people who reformed the humanities curriculum after that, in the early 40s, late 30s, the humanities curriculum is still in place, were publishing in that journal, American Review, edited by a man named Seward Collins. It's that kind of discovery. You know, you go back and read stuff that nobody reads anymore. Look for the books that are never checked out because they're not in vogue, and you'll be amazed.
And with that, we've kind of looped back to the beginning, which reveals that we barely scratched the surface. Why don't we give your contact information again, Claire, and give you 100,000 thanks for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure, and I will tell people that if this conversation seems too circuitous and nonlinear, it really isn't, and it's all laid out very systematically in my book, In Hunting Captain Ahab. And as I said, I'm perfectly willing to send my article on the scandalous Langer Report, which I call Clara Hitler's Son, Reading the Langer Report on Hitler's Mind. I will send it to you as published with footnotes and everything. And that has a lot on, you know, the so-called Jewish Hitler, and an analysis that you've never seen before. And plus, I'll also send you the sadomasochism talk that I gave on KPFK that's a real killer, and people really liked it, at least the ones that were listening at the time.
Great. And that's cSpark at
ix.netcom.com.
cSpark at ix.netcom.com. Okay, Claire, thanks so much for being with us, and we'll be talking to you soon enough.
Great. Thank you so much, and I hope that your listeners were stimulated and encouraged to do their own research. That's what I want them to do more than anything.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to Dr. Claire Spark in her second appearance on Michael Woodson's Living Art program on Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. The program aired on November 25th of 2005. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.